case, Evans versus Georgia Regional Hospital. Where everyone could sit at the same table, or they sit at separate tables, because we only really have one side of the argument to hear from. Let's let the courtroom get clear. Mr. Nevins.
All right, thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Greg Nevins with the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, and I represent Jamaica Evans in this case. Let's talk statutory textualism and statutory purpose. I have, in addition to just the text of the statute, I have four Supreme Court cases that tell you how to interpret that. You can't have one hiring policy for men and one hiring policy for women. That goes back 45 years. So you can't have a policy that says men can date women, but women can't date women. Manhart talks about not only that Title VII's geared at strikes the entire spectrum of disparate treatment based on gender stereotypes.
Let me cut to the chase for yes. My concern, okay? I read the complaint as potentially raising two different kind of claims, right? One would be a claim of discrimination based on gender nonconformity in conduct or behavior, right? Which this court has recognized as actionable under Title VII, right?
Yes, sir. Right.
And my concern about that claim is that perhaps there was really not enough alleged in the complaint to satisfy the Iqbal and Twombly standard, but it might very well mean that a motion for leave to amend should be granted and another opportunity to flesh that out should be given. That's one side of the equation for me. I can only speak for me. On the other is the notion that there's a claim based on discrimination based on sexual orientation, which is different from gender nonconformity. The problem I have with that claim, though, is that we got a pre-split Fifth Circuit opinion that says that Title VII doesn't cover that. Bloom versus Gulf Oil, 597 F. Second, 936, page 938. Discharge for homosexuality is not prohibited by Title VII or Section 1981.
Was that dicta, though?
I don't think it was, because it begins the opinion, per curiam opinion, by saying that whether appellant has stated a prima facie Title VII case of racial, sexual, or religious discrimination, it says all of that fails because there was a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for discharge. The claim about sexual orientation, though, is treated separately as at the end of the opinion as that's not actionable under Title VII or 1981. And it looks to me like we're bound by that precedent on that point.
Your Honor, first off, you're absolutely right about the first part of your analysis. I mean, what should happen is that dismissal, which of course was, and Ms. Evans even asked in pro per to relieve to amend, and it wasn't, and just got. So you're absolutely right. It should be reversed, and her gender stereotyping claim based on appearance and demeanor should go forward clearly.
Well, my concern is there. There probably needs to be more alleged,
and
with opportunity to amend on that claim, right?
Yeah, well, and you're right, and it would have to then satisfy the district court, but should have that opportunity. So I think we're on the same page with that. As far as Bloom, right. You'll recall it. This was a man who said, I was discriminated against because I'm a white, Jewish, gay male. And the court said, you weren't discriminated against because you're a white, Jewish, gay male. You were fired because you used the company phone for your own private business.
The problem with that, though, is it's not, with all due respect to our colleagues back then, not to me the best written opinion, but it's nevertheless a published opinion and binds me. And my concern about it is it says all of that with respect to different categories of protected grounds. And when it gets to the sexual orientation, he treats that separately at the end as not actionable. And that looks to me like holding.
Well, and if you, the two cases that are cited there, one is the Eighth Circuit case about what a Section 1981 claim is. That doesn't even talk about sexual orientation. It's only about that race is the only Section 1981 claim. The other case it's cited is another is a Fifth Circuit case from 1978 called Smith versus Liberty Mutual. That case was not about sexual orientation. Mr. Smith was fired from Liberty Mutual because of his supposed effeminacy. So you have, they're relying on a case that doesn't stand for the proposition that it stands for. It's a case that is absolutely bad law after Price Waterhouse.
Well, that case would be bad law because that would be gender nonconformity. That would be a separate issue. But I don't know that that didn't support what they were saying in terms of a broader proposition. If they understood that gender nonconformity was not actionable, erroneous, right?
This is obviously 10 years before Price Waterhouse, right? Yes.
Yeah, but a fortiori, right? Then a claim about sexual orientation itself wouldn't be actionable either. But if you flip it, right, the converse is not necessarily true. You could still have a claim for gender nonconformity, but not a claim for sexual orientation. Am I wrong about that?
Well,
just as a matter of logic.
I understand, but I think when you certainly some of the things that have been said about dicta in this court talk about stray remarks, not very well thought out, not carefully considered remarks, and so and the courts are free to revisit these things. And I think when the Supreme Court has said has utterly shattered the basis on which the decision, only decision that they rely on when that is totally obliterated, then I think that I think this court not only can but must revisit that and actually evaluate it, because if the idea is that if they said, look, of course, if you're, we just said a year ago that if you're fired because you're an effeminate man, you don't have a claim. So of course, if you're a gay man, you don't have a claim. And Price Waterhouse removes all of that. Then I think this court should reassess this in light of Price Waterhouse and see whether it still makes sense.
I mean, how could it make sense that if you, and I think you argue this in your brief, how could it make sense that if you cannot discriminate on failure to conform to so-called gender norms, that you could discriminate against someone because, for example, a woman doesn't conform to the gender norm of dating a man? I mean, why is that not the exact same thing?
It is, Your Honor, and when the court in Price Waterhouse said entire spectrum, they really meant it, because they went back to the Manhart case. The Manhart case talks about the entire spectrum of disparate treatment based on gender stereotypes. What was the stereotype at issue there? That women live longer than men. Well, that's not just a stereotype. That's not certainly a stereotype in the vernacular that we talk about stereotypes. That's an actuarial fact. And yet the court said to generalize about that and to treat all women and make all women pay more into the pension fund is wrong. So to have a categorical rule that says no women can date men because that's a stereotype. Women shouldn't be dating. I mean, no women can date women because it's a stereotype that women shouldn't be doing that. Then it matches up perfectly. So I think when you look at the various cases that have revisited either alternative holdings or dicta in prior opinions, you see that over and over the things that are most concerning the court is how thoughtful the prior analysis was, and also was it based on good law? Because if it wasn't based on good law, and of course as Your Honor is well familiar, the earlier precedent is the controlling precedent. The Fifth Circuit ruled in 1969 that you can't discriminate against women because of gender stereotypes. There it was the stereotype, women shouldn't be working late. They should be at home. They should be at home tending to their children. Of course, we also know that there's the stereotype against women in the workplace in dangerous jobs or jobs that involve heavy lifting. Of course, in the Fifth Circuit said, well, and back in 1974, don't stereotype, don't assume they can't do it. If you have a neutral evaluation of that, that's one thing. But don't say that women can't work late if they may want to. Don't say that they shouldn't be in dangerous jobs Maybe they want to, and those cases are significant precedents that have been, and the Weeks case has been reaffirmed twice by the, and quoted with favor twice by the Supreme Court. So if you're actually going back in time to 1979 to the Bloom case, I think you also have to go back in time to the 1969 case, and you would have to reconcile that. You'd have to reconcile Bloom with both Price Waterhouse and with Weeks. Also, of course, there's the Parr versus Woodman's case, which, and there's a situation where, where the interracial relationship that got Mr. Parr summarily removed from consideration of employment there was based on the fact that obviously that he was a white man with a black wife, and of course some courts have been saying, well, that's discrimination against someone based on their spouse. This court became the first federal appellate court to recognize, you are considering the race of the spouse, but you're also considering the race of the employee, and that's forbidden under Title VII. And there are no fewer than four Supreme Court cases that say race and sex, even though, of course, they're very different.
Several circuits held, though, that Title VII doesn't extend to sexual orientation as opposed to behavior that doesn't conform to a gender stereotype. I mean, several circuits have held that, and no circuit has yet. As I read the cases, I'm just trying to make it seems to me, if we're bound by Bloom, and I'm concerned that we are, that seems to be consistent with how every other circuit that's addressed the issue has also ruled.
And I think you have to look at what the rationale for those circuit decisions were. Because as it was pointed out not too long ago, other circuits can get these things wrong.
Yes.
And when Justice Scalia said for unanimous...
This one's not one where there's a split, as there was
Not yet.
There could be one
very soon. But Your Honor, the more important thing is, unlike the previous case, there's Supreme Court authority that says, you know what, if you're going beyond what the 88th Congress intended, that's okay. If you're following the words of the statute, if this is discrimination because of sex, and there it was, Joseph on call out in a rig in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, the idea that he was going to have a claim for sex discrimination because he was a male, farthest thing from the mind of the 88th Congress, right? Justice Scalia, for unanimous court, said, don't worry about that. You follow the words of the statute.
Right.
And then
I'm totally with you on that.
What? And not only that, though, Your Honor, I mean, what this court decided in the Carver Middle School is we have to pay attention to the statutes that are being put before the court to say, is there coverage under this statute? Yes, maybe the Florida legislature in that case did something that doesn't really help the argument, that makes it more difficult for us to decide this. But we still have to decide the case under the statute that we actually have, we wish we had.
Mr. Nevins, maybe my fault. I could have been clearer about this. I guess my concern is, I mean, you've said perhaps that we are not bound by Bloom, that it was inconsistent with prior Supreme Court precedent, later Supreme Court precedent, its reasoning has really been undermined. We have a very strong prior panel precedent rule in this circuit. And to say that a prior panel precedent has been abrogated requires something really clear and unequivocal in terms of later Supreme Court precedent. One of my concerns is there are a lot more recent sister circuit decisions that seem to reach the same conclusion that Bloom did, notwithstanding those more recent Supreme Court precedents. And it's hard for me to see how we could, in good faith, say that our prior panel precedent rule is not implicated. It might be then an occasion for rehearing en banc, a different problem, but we have to respect the prior panel precedent rule. That's my concern.
Well, I certainly agree with your honor that it would be a situation for rehearing en banc if that were necessary. But I really do think, I mean, I think this court's highest and first priority is to interpret the words of the statute as the Supreme Court said. And most of these cases, rely on what Congress did not do. They haven't passed explicit sexual orientation protections. That doesn't, that's not, doesn't answer the question. There, none of these cases that you're talking about from these other circuits are, they never, they don't follow Supreme Court precedent.
But what they say, though, is that discrimination on the basis of sex does not mean sexual orientation. That's what they say.
Right. It's not very thoughtful.
Which is what Bloom says, too.
And they also rely so much on Congress's failure to pass specific protections. But that's not the proper analysis.
I agree with you. That's faulty analysis. I agree with you. That's not the way you interpret statutes.
I mean, if the Supreme
Court doesn't answer
you,
my prior panel precedent rule.
Well, I don't know what the limitations of that are. I mean, I do know in the Protka opinion that this court, you know, went back on a decision by the just 3 years previously that many, many courts had relied on extensively about the scope of who gets to do class actions and under what rule. And that, and the earlier decision was very thoughtful, was very thorough and was very specific in what it said, and yet this court overruled that and said it was wrong because it was dicta. It wasn't necessary to the decision of the case. I respectfully submit that in this case you should do the same.
I have a question.
Yes,
for you.
Please.
So if Price Waterhouse did not abrogate Bloom, then where can we draw an intellectually honest line between gender stereotyping based on gender norms, which Price Waterhouse clearly found you cannot do, and being LGBT, which seems to be based on gender stereotypes, based on norms. How can we intellectually, honestly draw a line to define why it is that one falls into the category of prohibited by Title VII, whereas the other falls outside of it?
You know, I don't know, Your Honor, and the attempts to have done, the attempts to do that have been almost laughable.
Isn't it this, though? I mean, the notion, there's a difference between status and behavior.
Well, Your Honor, to Judge Rosenbaum's question,
but that's an intellectually honest and principled distinction, isn't it?
I'm not sure that it is, because the for instance, in the Vickers case, the court said that of course it's a gender stereotype that men are going to be attracted to women, and that Chris Vickers didn't conform to that stereotype. But they said we're not going to hold that to be actionable because it didn't manifest itself in the workplace. Well, that's a ridiculous distinction under Title VII. That would mean that the person who is very quiet about their interracial marriage could be discriminated against, or the person who never says that they go to a synagogue could be discriminated against because of their religion, whereas the person who openly talks about those things could be. That's a distinction that makes no sense, Your Honor. And I respectfully submit that none of the circuits have grappled with that in an intellectually honest way. I thank the court. Unless there are
I'm confused, yes, about something. So you've got this, by my sheet, it says that you have a 5-minute rebuttal reserve. I don't know how there could be any rebuttal when we don't have another side here.
They asked me if I wanted to split it up, and I thought, well, maybe. Your Honor, that's all there is.
Is there really any point in that? Do you have anything else?
You know, I don't think I'm going to come back too hard on what the...
I don't think you are either. So.
but I thank you for...
Thank you.
I thank the court for it.
Ms. Coleman.
May it please the court, I'm Gail Coleman for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The cases from other circuits that hold that sexual orientation discrimination is not prohibited by Title VII almost uniformly either occurred before Price Waterhouse, those precedents are pre-Price Waterhouse, or without analysis, they cite back to pre-Price Waterhouse precedents. So there really has been no reasoned decision from another circuit that has said Title VII does not prohibit sexual orientation discrimination other than Hively in the Seventh Circuit, which was a recent panel decision, which did hold that on the panel basis, but went to great, great lengths trying to figure out how that could possibly be reconciled with Price Waterhouse. And really, the panel worked very, very hard to find a way to try to distinguish sexual orientation discrimination from discrimination based on a failure to conform to gender norms. and had a very hard time doing it, and then ultimately the full Seventh Circuit vacated that opinion and has now reheard the case en banc and is considering whether to overturn its prior precedent because it is really impossible to distinguish Price Waterhouse. So to the extent that you're concerned about Bloom and about other circuit precedent, the fact that we have this intervening Supreme Court decision now in Price Waterhouse really is what is controlling. In Glenn, this court dealt with a similar issue dealing with transgender people. And there, the court correctly noted that people who are transgender are actually defined by the fact that they are violating a gender norm. And therefore, discrimination based on transgender status is inherently sex discrimination. Well, that's true here, too. In order to be defined as a gay man or as a lesbian, you're being defined that way because you are not complying with the quintessential gender norm of same-sex, opposite-sex attraction. What we assume is that men are going to be attracted to women and women are going to be attracted to men. And in the case of gays and lesbians, that's not the case. That is a violation of a gender norm, and there is no way to carve that out. Nothing in the statute, nothing in Price Waterhouse, nothing in Glenn, which says that all people are protected from discrimination on the basis of gender stereotypes. Nothing in any of those cases or in the statute allows a carve-out exception for sexual orientation discrimination.
I am concerned about our prior panel precedent, but in Glenn, you have a worker who basically is working for the Georgia legislature who says, a male, who says, beginning next week, I'll be presenting as a female. And I'll have a different name, different manner of dress, and it's very clear that that individual was discriminated against because of their behavior, their failure to conform to a gender stereotype. I could very well, though, never know someone's sexual orientation, right?
Well, I have two responses to that. The first is that you can have two employees who go out and get married over the weekend, a male and a female employee, and they go out and get married, yeah. And on Monday they come to work, and each one puts a picture of their wife on the desk.
Yes.
The male employee keeps his job. The female employee with a picture of her wife...
That would be, and that would clearly fall within the Glenn precedent, it seems to me.
That's straight
if the reason, if the reason for that was that that picture displayed a same-sex spouse.
Well, exactly, and that
behavior, though, and but if that worker never shows up for work, right, and does that, it's the more difficult problem. I may never know what that person's sexual orientation is.
Well, but under that reasoning, we get to the lines of cases that more and more district courts and that the Hively Court and certainly the EEOC are seeing no real line because there you would grant Title VII protection to an employee who was harassed or terminated or discriminated against in some way because coworkers believe without any evidence that he's gay. So perhaps it's because he's behaving in an effeminate manner for whatever. Perceived homosexuality is protected. Whereas if these employee, the coworkers are guessing correctly, then all of a sudden it's something else in a sexual orientation discrimination instead of sex discrimination. There just isn't a logical way to draw that line. I see my time is up unless there are questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your argument. We will be in recess until tomorrow morning.